Ready to proceed?
The facts in this case aren't really in dispute, so unless the court has questions concerning the factual background, I would prefer not to spend time this morning going over the factual scenario of what brought us here this morning. The issue in the case, however, is whether or not those facts create a workers' compensation liability, or to say it another way, whether those facts establish that the flu vaccination that the claimant, Ms. Fopel, received is something that arose from her employment. We asked this court this morning to examine the facts in the world that we live in here in 2004 and not in the world that was in existence when Professor Larson wrote his treatise and when the New Jersey case of Sandsting versus Steinbeck was decided. As the court knows full well, the Industrial Accident Board and the Superior Court both relied upon Professor Larson's treatise, and they both relied upon the Sandsting decision in reaching the ultimate conclusion that they reached, which was to the effect that a workers' compensation liability was created.
You know, Mr. Ralston, I read your brief as acknowledging that the standard we're looking for is still, was there strong urging and was there mutual benefit? Are you now going to suggest that is not the standard?
No, Your Honor, we do not suggest that the court disavow Larson and those standards. What we suggest to the court, though, is that the way those standards were applied, both at the accident board level and the superior court level, is just not in tune with a realistic view of the facts that were presented to the Industrial Accident Board. We do not disavow that concept. We just ask the court to look at it in a modern context and not a 1949 context.
Well, what has happened between 1949 and 2004 that would have made the application of that rule to these facts correct back then but not today?
The world has changed, Your Honor, and we bring it...
How has it relevantly changed?
It's relevantly changed because different liabilities have potentially been created that go way beyond the employer-employee relationship, that take us into a scenario such as the ones we suggest in our brief, not to be overly dramatic, but in the post-September 11th world, situations can exist where employers are asked by state aid, by the state, or by the federal government to participate in programs such as inoculation programs. Under these facts, in the 1949 world, the Industrial Accident Board created a potential liability there. And I would suggest that that's certainly not what the framers of the compensation statute way back in the early 1900s contemplated. What we're suggesting is the changing world means that we need to take a different look or a fresher look at the concept of what is really a mutual benefit and what really is a strong urging. Another example that's less dramatic than the September 11th type example is wellness programs, for instance, where the state and the federal government encourages employers to participate in that type of program. That's not something that goes back to the traditional employer-employee relationship. It's something where the government or agencies are asking employers to help in the interest of the general welfare of the public as a whole, not particular employees. That's always been what workers' compensation is based upon, an employer-employee relationship. And just by way of example, these are developments that have occurred in our world, our society, since way back in 1949 when the Sandsting case was decided, and since certainly our framers of the compensation statute in roughly 1918 drafted the statute.
Well, Mr. Ralston, let's look at the strong urging component first. And I'm looking at page 11 of the Superior Court's opinion that you attached to your brief and tying it into our standard of review. And there, the Superior Court quotes the Industrial Accident Board as saying, the frequency of the reminders constitutes urging, And then it goes on to talk about the placement of the flyers on page 4. It talks about, you know, in all caps, flu shots, and the number of emails going directly to the employees. So help us, if we really have the standard, but we're trying to distinguish it based on these facts, given our standard of review, why weren't the direct emails, the frequency of the emails, the magnitude of the notice enough to support a finding of strong urging?
Well, once again, Your Honor, I'll preface that by saying that whole concept of notice has to be looked at in today's world, not in an old world. Bulk emails, and there was evidence that bulk emails were sent out. And I don't think it takes a lot to suggest that bulk emails are a modern form of the bulletin board. Large employers send out bulk emails all the time. Small employers do it as well. I got a bulk email from the Bar Association this week. That's just the way people communicate in this day and age. They don't put notices on a bulletin board. They send out a bulk email. So I would suggest that that certainly does not amount to an urging or a strong urging to get this vaccination. The courts and Larson seem to take the approach that urging means you're suggesting that someone should go ahead and receive the vaccination. In this particular case, in this particular record, there's certainly nothing to suggest that DuPont's notices urged anybody to do anything. In fact, the accident board's decision, I think it's at page 15 or 16 of their decision, they admit that there's nothing on those notices that urges an employee to do anything.
So you would have us then focus on the content as opposed to the frequency, and to the extent, no matter how many emails you got or how many notices you got, as long as a reasonable employee would conclude that it was strictly an opportunity, totally voluntary, then there's no urging.
I think that's what we would suggest it would be an appropriate rule, Your Honor. And in this case, the board and the Superior Court recognized that there was no urging. In fact, the evidence in this case was to the contrary.
Well, the notice did not use the word urging or strongly urge, correct?
That's correct.
But the employees were barraged with a series of these emails that certainly could have created the impression that this is what the company wanted to happen.
I would suggest, Your Honor, though, that has to be evaluated in terms of what the notice said. The notice was a logistical type of notice that provided information as to where the shots were being given and when they were being given. My response to that is this is a program that DuPont was asked to participate in, or agreed to participate in, I should say, to help promote the general welfare and provide these flu vaccinations in response to the Center for Disease Control and physicians and that type of thing. And the rhetorical question that we ask in our brief that I think is an appropriate question is it reasonable to conclude that DuPont should be involved in this program and then tell nobody about it?
Let's backtrack for a moment. The question I asked was, given the frequency of these email barrages and the notices being stickered all over the workplace, couldn't a reasonable employee infer that DuPont was, by act or by deed, urging them to get flu shots? Your response, I think, is maybe, but that inference could be counteracted by what is by the content of the notice. Is that right?
Your Honor,
yes or no?
I don't know that a reasonable employee would make a decision one way or the other. What I do know is on this record, the evidence was that there was no compulsion for anyone to get.
We understand that. We're talking about impression. That is, the company creating the impression by the frequency and by the geography of the notice. And I'm just asking you whether an employee could derive that impression.
an employee certainly could derive that impression, but that doesn't answer the question of whether or not that rises to the level under the totality of the circumstances of amounting to an urging, much less a strong urging.
Okay, well, and what I'm asking you is, what is the totality of the circumstances that would counteract that impression and make it unreasonable as a matter of law?
The totality of the circumstances is that everyone agrees, I don't even think Ms. Fulpel suggests this, and the accident board and the superior court had found that the notices in and of themselves are neutral in terms of any type of urging, but that's simply not there.
So does it come down to, does your argument come down to the proposition that there has to be some language, some actual language in the notice that encourages or exhorts or something to that effect?
In terms of whether or not there's urging, that's correct. That's
if it doesn't have that language in it, then it doesn't matter how frequent the emails or whether the notices are stickered on every square foot of space in the workplace.
In and of itself, but Your Honor, I would suggest that we have to go beyond one fact and look at all of the facts in the case. Certainly, even with a neutral type of announcement, if there was evidence in the record that, for instance, there were incentives for cooperating and going along with the program, if there were repercussions, if there was anything that took it out from a purely voluntary type of situation, then that could perhaps trump the notices. But we don't have any of that here. The other answer I would make, and I don't know whether this makes sense to Your Honor, but I think the court can take notice of the fact that we're dealing with the DuPont building in downtown Wilmington, a building that takes up one square block of ground, a building that is many floors high, and when you get to the concept that you find liability based upon quantity, which is what the board did and what the superior court did, you create almost an impossible standard. Again, it was DuPont expected to put one notice in the DuPont building? Are they allowed to put two notices? Are they allowed to put a notice per floor? When does it become too much? The point I make is that the information is what should be key in terms of whether or not it's suggested that anything's happening to take it outside the purely voluntary nature.
Can I interrupt you there?
Yes, Your Honor.
Are you saying that unless there was some fact that made it less than voluntary, there should be no workers' compensation? What I'm getting at is that strong urging, to me, doesn't mean sanctions if you don't do it, or monetary or other tangible incentives if you do it. That could be strong urging, certainly, but is it your view that in order to satisfy a strong urging standard, there would have to be some explicit sanction and or benefit, as opposed to simply encouraging your employees to do something and letting them know that this is something that the employer considers important and would be beneficial, and we hope you'll all do it?
I think, Your Honor, that the benefit or the does not have to be tangible in the sense of a fine or a repercussion or something like that, but there has to be something to take it out of the purely voluntary type of situation. In this case, on this record, there's nothing, even to take it into a less than tangible incentive for Ms. Fulpel to have the flu shot. She testified that she thought she should have the flu shot. She didn't testify that she was told by her boss that she should get it. She said she felt she should get it. She said a couple of other things. She said that she felt she should get it because her doctor recommended it. She felt she should get it because she was helping to care for her elderly parents. She did not testify, and no other witnesses came to testify that, well, even though it's not there, there's this subtle coercion. She said that, well, I got these notices and I thought I probably should get it, but if you read the context of her testimony, it's because she subjectively felt that she should get the shot for a number of different reasons. There's nothing there to suggest that it came from the employer. And I would suggest that that's the real test. Was there anything coming from the employer?
Well, Mr. Ralston, when DuPont agrees to participate in this program, how voluntary is that on DuPont's part? And then once it participates, what does the record reflect on its obligations?
I don't think there's anything in the record to answer the question of how voluntary is it on DuPont's part for them to participate in the program. The only evidence that I recall came from Mr. Sparks, who was the nurse, and he testified that it was a remnant of their old non-occupational type of medicine that they provided to their employees. But I don't think there's anything to suggest that, or to answer Your Honor's question as to what, if any, compulsion was there. The testimony, as I recall, was to the effect that DuPont did it because they thought it was a good thing for the general welfare of the public and obviously their employees. In terms of the follow-through, the only evidence that I recall came from Mr. Sparks again, which was that a lot of people participated. But in terms of whether or not there was any requirement that DuPont go out and get all of the people involved or all the departments involved, the only evidence on that regard came again from Mr. Sparks, and that was to the effect that no one got a bonus for 100% participation, no supervisors were given any type of credit if they could get everyone in their department to participate. So I don't think there's any direct evidence to answer Your Honor's question, but certainly the implication from Mr. Sparks' testimony is there was no program that would reward anybody within DuPont if they could get the employees in a particular department to participate.
At the undoubted risk of being accused of personalizing this, let me try to get this in my own mind in some kind of perspective. Assume that the state of Delaware monthly sends out a wellness bulletin encouraging state of Delaware employees to participate in physical fitness programs, and in fact encourages them to do so by subsidizing the cost if they go to a local facility that provides a fitness program. Assume an employee does that at that in response, not only because they have their own independent reasons for doing it, but because the state's urging them to do it and subsidize it. And then that employee is injured on the premises, engaged in the physical fitness program after regular work hours and not otherwise engaged in the regular course of business. Would that be, under this theory that applies in this case, the kind of circumstance that would enable that person to make a claim for workers' compensation benefits?
Your Honor, I certainly think under the Industrial Accident Board's decision and the Superior Court's decision, that type of scenario would be compensable for workers' compensation purposes. The point we're trying to make is that in order to leap from a pure employer-employee relationship, it's necessary to look at other factors. And while we certainly don't disavow the urging argument, and while we certainly don't disavow the benefit argument, we think that the case has to be examined on its facts based upon whether or not there was a purely voluntary participation by the employee. If I heard Your Honor correctly, there would be a question as to whether or not that participation in that program, that wellness program, was purely voluntary because of the urging and because the employee thought that, well, maybe I should do this because it would, it's something my employer wants me to do.
Yeah, well, what I'm hung up on is I don't know what strongly urging brings to the table in the absence of a crisis like in the New Jersey case where there had been an outbreak of smallpox, because it's patently obvious intuitively that the better physical condition you're in, the fewer medical bills the state of Delaware will have for you, and the healthier you will be. So other than applying pure reason, what's the strong urging that's involved in the situation?
And Your Honor, I think that's perhaps a key as to why we ask the court to not disavow the urging concept and not disavow everything that Larson talked about, but to look at it realistically and look at it with the type of points that Your Honor made and that I've attempted to make in the new world. There are lots of things that happen for the general welfare of the public. Those things are not traditional workers' compensation concepts. Why should an employer be penalized because a case was decided in 1949 and used certain language when logic, as Your Honor suggests, tells us that, well, gee whiz, it's in everybody's interest to be healthy. That's not the traditional employer-employee relationship, and that's why we ask the court to look at this whole concept in a new light. You don't have to reject the concepts, but what we're suggesting is that you look at them in the modern world that we all live in.
Mr. Olson, I think of the strongly urging as an attempt to tie this closer or more closely to a condition of employment sort of concept. And in the New Jersey case, one might have assumed that the employees who were strongly urged felt that in order to continue their employment, they had to comply. Should we read the strongly urging language or the test in that way?
I don't know whether it's necessary to read it quite in that way, but it's necessary or appropriate, I would suggest, to apply it to these facts. In these facts, there's nothing to suggest that anything would happen to anyone if that particular employee opted out of the vaccination program or decided to get it from a private physician. There's certainly nothing to tie it to the employer-employee relationship.
Well, you would agree that if you made participation in the program a condition of employment, then it would be permanently tied to the employment, and it would give rise to a workers' compensation liability, wouldn't you?
Yes, I would agree with that, and that's akin to the case where people need to have vaccinations because they're nurses or because they're going overseas or something such as that, or because an employer adopts a policy saying that we want everyone to have a flu shot and it's mandatory. It takes it away from voluntary. It brings it into the employer-employee relationship.
Right. So isn't this test that was devised really sort of a substitute to sort of sniff out coercion, sniff out situations where people feel coerced into or somehow obliged to participate?
I don't know whether I would use the word coercion, but I think it's a test that's suggested in order to avoid situations where employers put pressure on people to have this type of vaccination. And going back to the record, there's no evidence of that in this case.
Is there anything in the record that suggests that the conditions at the DuPont building in Wilmington were different than the conditions in which this same employee had worked at the Chestnut Run facility?
As
it relates to this program.
No, I don't believe there's anything in the record to suggest that one way or the other than the fact that she got a different job and moved downtown.
Well, she did testify that the program was in effect at Chestnut Run as well, didn't she?
That's correct, she did. And she testified that she had elected not to participate in the program, and then when she moved downtown, she decided in 2001 to participate.
And is there anything in the record that suggests that the change was because there was more strong urging downtown than there had been in Chestnut Run?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think the only evidence in the record was to the effect that she subjectively felt that because she had an executive-type secretarial position that she did not want to miss time from work, and that she felt subjectively that she should have that shot.
Well, I want to make sure that you have an opportunity to answer everyone's questions. You have less than 2 minutes left.
I realize that, Your Honor.
Do you want to save it or respond to questions that I think are still forthcoming?
I will be happy to respond to questions. I would rather do that than save my time.
And just one question. I think the record does reflect, and you said this earlier, that her doctor also suggested in 2001 that she get the flu shot. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. She testified that in the summer she went to see her doctor, and he suggested she was in the age group where she might want to consider having the shot. She also testified that she was dealing with elderly parents, and she thought that was another reason why the shot might be helpful.
I think you stated that if the getting the shot were a condition of employment, that would be sufficient compulsion to make the injury compensable, that is, a work-related injury. What if the notice said it's not required, but we strongly urge you to get it? What then?
Well, I think you get to the content of the notice, which I discussed with Justice Holland, where once you put in anything that would suggest that an employee should get it,
compensable.
Then I think it becomes compensable.
What if it said you don't have to, but we'd like you to?
I think, again, that's language that certainly one could argue and a fact finder could find. I have to go back to that. I think the fact finder could find either way. But certainly if the fact finder found that to be compensable, there's urging in that language that they could hang their hats on.
So urging could be a preference expressed by the employer without compulsion type language.
And I think that gets to the point that I think Justice Berger was making, which was to the effect that there could be subtle suggestions that don't necessarily convert to monetary type of situations. Yes, if an employee feels that there's a real reason why the employer wants you to have it, then it would become compensable.
Thank you, Mr. Olson.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Joseph Boyk, and I represent Ms. Fontel, the workers' compensation claimant in this case. The issue that you need to decide is rather narrowly drawn. There's really no dispute that the flu shot Ms. Fontel received at work caused her to develop a condition known as Guillain-Barré syndrome, a crippling neurological problem. And there's really no dispute that she received the shot while within the course of her employment. She would have her place of employment when she received the shot. She was on company time when she received the shot. In fact, she only had to walk down the hallway to get the shot. The shot was administered by a fellow employee. The real issue that you need to decide is whether there was substantial evidence in the record to allow the Industrial Accident Board to correctly determine that the vaccination was given and arising out of Fontel's employment at DuPont. Both the Industrial Accident Board and the Superior Court found a reasonable causal connection between the injury sustained by Ms. Fontel and her employment. Part of that reasoning was that it was uncontested that this vaccination program was only made available to DuPont employees. It was paid for by DuPont, it was given at company time, given at their facility, and it was not open to the public. Now, the thrust of DuPont's argument against Ms. Fontel's claim is twofold. And the first you touched upon quite often in Mr. Ralston's opening, that there was no urging or compulsion by DuPont. However, the facts and evidence show that there was sufficient evidence to refute this contention. Let's look at the urging or compulsion argument. Now, both the board and the Superior Court looked at the New Jersey case, the St. Cyr case, for support of their decision. In St. Cyr, the employer made arrangements for the Department of Health to come into a facility to give the smallpox vaccination on a single day. That notice stated that they wanted to promote the vaccine, and they posted a notice, and it said, quote, to all those who choose to be immunized, close quote. It was strictly voluntary. The notice, however, went on to say at the bottom, quote, we strongly urge that you take advantage of this service, close quote. And that's where the strong urging language came from in Professor Larson's article. It didn't come from a great body of jurisprudence. In fact, if you look at the other cases that were cited by the Superior Court, the Pertzi case and I believe it was Lampkin's case out of Florida and Missouri, there was no discussion whatsoever of any strong urging. The focus upon that there was there a benefit to the employer and the employee? Now, when you look at the case that was decided in New Jersey, the St. Cyr case, the court there stated that the posted notice, and they looked at other cases as well, constituted a suggestion, an invitation, and an urge that was calculated to induce an employee to submit to treatment who might not otherwise have done so. And what's the number one excuse we have for not going to the doctor or getting something like this? I don't want to take time off from work. They made it available for their employees at work. Now, in contrast to St. Cyr, where there was the single notice that was posted at the place of employment, look at the facts of this case. When the claimant came to the work in the morning and she opened the door, there was a poster promoting the flu shot. When she sat at her desk and she turned her computer on, there was an email promoting the flu shot. When she went to the copy room to make copies for her boss, there was the notice. When she went to the ladies' room, there was the notice. When she left at the end of the day, there was yet another notice. The notices were not as benign as DuPont would have you say. If you look at the one that was actually put in evidence where it says flu shot scheduled, there's four rather bold exclamation points there. They also stated, while supplies last. There was also, more importantly, specific times that they set aside for each department to come in and get the flu shot. Sort of the corporate culture of getting people to get in there and really encouraging them to get in there and get that flu shot.
Mr. Blake, your client worked for DuPont for 25 years or so, or
That's approximately correct.
Or even longer, perhaps. But there's evidence that in 1976 she got a shot, and then she resisted all this urging for 23 or 24 years.
That's correct.
She never got another shot.
That's correct.
And one can assume that there were, maybe there wasn't email, but there were posters everywhere.
That's correct. But that ties to the second point, and that is, was there a mutual benefit between Ms. Falpel and DuPont? She decided to get that flu shot in 2001 because she had moved from the Chestnut Run facility to a management facility. She quite clearly testified she felt that she got that flu shot because she had to be there for her boss, and excessive absenteeism would disrupt the orderly conduct of that office.
Well, Mr. White, you don't get to the second point until you finish with Vice Chancellor Lamb's question on the first point, which is, was there urging, if we want to use that word, encouragement, promotion? You saw the exchange the court had with Mr. Ralston, and I think what Vice Chancellor Lamb's question raises is, were there any repercussions from not getting the flu shot? And the record seems to suggest that there were other changes in her personal circumstances that led her to get the flu shot. So what does the record show?
Well,
you know, if for 20 years she didn't get the flu shot, there were no repercussions for her in the workplace, and she apparently didn't get the flu or didn't get sick enough to say, well, maybe if I get the shot next year, I won't get sick. Why all of a sudden does she feel the employer really wants her to do this? I think we can all see the mutual benefit of people not being absent. But what we're looking at in the first phase is, what did the employer do in 2001 that moved her in to get the flu shot?
Unfortunately, the record is devoid of a before and after analysis. We really didn't put into evidence what was going on at the Chestnut Run facility before 2001. The only evidence that we have to deal with is the evidence of what was going on at the Wilmington facility in 2001, and that is what Barbara Falpel testified to. And if you recall from her testimony, she said all of this barrage of information to her was, in her words, a, quote, constant subliminal reminder by DuPont that she needed to get the flu shot. But unfortunately, there was nothing in the record to say what the notices were prior to 2001. So I unfortunately can't answer that.
Well, okay. How, if your view prevails, how does an employer convey good, helpful information to an employee without subjecting itself to workman's compensation type of liability?
Your Honor, that would have to depend on the facts and circumstances of each case. And we need to focus just on the facts in this case. I'm not sure what type of notices that an employer would give that could rise to that level. Now, certainly in other circumstances, employees participating in, say, company softball leagues that are injured, they've been able to collect workers' compensation benefits. Other facilities that the employer has made available just for the personal convenience of the employee, if they're injured during those type of activities, they've been found compensable. When the Industrial Accident Board was faced with this factual determination, and when they were faced with this evidence, they made a determination on the facts that the frequency of reminders, the placement of the flyers, and the direct emails all constituted a strong urging on the part of DuPont. This was a finding of fact that was based on substantial evidence that cannot be disturbed on appeal.
Well, isn't it? It's a mixed question of fact and law, certainly, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. But I'll go back. When the Superior Court decided the case, and they looked at the cases out of Florida and out of Missouri, I believe, where there was a finding of compensability, there was virtually no discussion in those cases of any strong urging. They did mention the requirement of strong urging, but there was no factual determination. The focus in that case was on whether or not this accident happened within the course and scope of employment. And that brings you to the second argument that DuPont made, and that is that there was no mutual benefit. Now, this court has decided workers' compensation claims many, many times in the past. And they've always found that a compensable injury does not have to take place during a job-related activity if the employee is injured conducting an activity that resulted from a facility or act of the employer that was provided for the convenience of the employee. In those circumstances, the injury may be compensable. That's the Tickles case decided by this court in 1997. This is in accordance with what I touched on before, the personal comfort doctrine. People injured using the company cafeteria. If Ms. Popel had gone to the company cafeteria and got food poisoning from eating bad food, there'd be no question that it would be compensable. If she parked her car in the company parking lot and tripped over a curb and she fell, there'd be no question it would be compensable. If she tripped walking to get the flu shot on a carpet in the hallway and she broke her arm, it would be compensable. Personal comfort that takes place within the facility of the employer, provided by the employer, has risen on multiple times to a finding of compensability because it's tied in some way to the employment activities.
How far do we go with this? Going back to physical fitness promoted by an employer because it reduces the medical cost of the employer for fit employees as opposed to unfit employees. And there's a company softball game at a softball field that's reserved or leased by the company for that purpose. And an employee is injured playing for the company softball team. Is that a compensable injury under your definition, though it's off the premises because it's a mutual benefit?
Yes. In fact, I believe there's been a Delaware case on point. I don't recall exactly where a state trooper was injured when someone put one of those batting rings on a bat and swung it, came out and hit the trooper in the face.
Nobody ever rules against the state police, but that's not the issue. Generally, how broad does this go?
If there is some tie between the employment activities, facilities supplied by the employer, and the injury, then there can be a finding of compensability based on the facts and circumstances of each case. In this case, the board looked at the totality of the circumstances and the facts and concluded that this act occurred within the scope and in the course of Ms. Falpel's employment and awarded compensability. Remember, I said that before, Ms. Falpel felt she had to be there. As stated by the Industrial Accident Board, DuPont had a practical interest in avoiding absenteeism. They had a practical interest in making the flu shot available. They had a practical interest in making it available at their facility and on company time to avoid the excuse, I just didn't have time to get the flu shot.
Does it follow from your argument that the strongly urging test just really doesn't apply here?
In my personal opinion, I think the strongly urging test does not need to apply in this circumstance. And if you look at the Superior Court decision, they still found strong urging, but when they cited the Florida and Missouri cases, there was no specific finding in that case. What they found was, as long as there's a causal relationship between the injury and the employment, that was sufficient to make a causal nexus and allow workers' compensation benefits to be applied. In this case, Ms. Falknell got the flu shot on company time, company place by a fellow employee, so that she could, number one, be there for her company, number two, avoid absenteeism, and three, avoid the spread of the disease among fellow employees in a closed work environment.
Well, Mr. White, help the court understand the interaction of two doctrines that normally are mutually exclusive, and that is, to a certain extent, DuPont would limit its liability according to the statutory scheme if this was compensable. If it's not compensable because we conclude it wasn't within the scope of employment, does that mean that DuPont has greater liability for negligence in administering these flu shots?
Well, as a matter of fact, yes. That was, if you look at the Lampkins case that was decided in Missouri, that was a tort claim. That was not a workers' compensation claim. The employee brought an action against his employer because he had a reaction to a shot that he got on the job. He was trying to sue his employer in tort for damages. The court turned the tables on him and said, no, that was a workers' comp scope and course of employment, and under the exclusive remedy rule, you cannot sue your employer. I would therefore just in summary urge that you adopt the well-reasoned opinion of the Superior Court and affirm the decision. Thank you.
Was the personal comfort doctrine argued in the Superior Court?
The personal comfort doctrine was brought up in the briefing at the Superior Court, and it was mentioned because in some of the other cases, they used it as an analogous situation to this case.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. White.
You're welcome.
Before we recess, I want to acknowledge the presence in court today, the group of international attorneys brought to us by the University of Delaware and the University's American Law and Legal English Institute. On behalf of all the members of the court, welcome to Delaware and welcome to our arguments. I do want to make a special comment to the gentleman from Morocco and tell him that 50 years ago on this day, I was living in Morocco and lived in that country for 2 years. So, special welcome to you, sir. The court's in recess. We'll take the case under advisement.
Please rise.